It's Friday, January 29th, and you're very welcome to this weekend edition of Inside Politics from the Irish Times. I'm Pat Leahy. Yesterday, Pascal Donoghue published the government's debt sustainability report, outlining the growth in the national debt and the views of the Department of Finance on how manageable it all is. While the numbers are enormous, the debt grew by 20-odd billion last year and is projected to do the same again this year, and will end up at about 240 billion by the end of this year, the current stance of central banks is that governments should borrow these vast sums to pay for the pandemic. So much of the market's bought into this approach that the cost of borrowing for the Irish government has fallen to historic lows, and the cost of servicing the national debt this year will actually be smaller than last year, even though the debt itself is bigger. Figure that out. But these are extraordinary measures for extraordinary times. And when the pandemic passes, as it will, no matter how hard that is to imagine right now, governments will be required to broadly align their current expenditure with their revenues to pay their way without recourse to borrowing for the day-to-day costs of running the state. No state can afford to permanently run large budget deficits. Sooner or later, the debt will reach unsustainable levels. We will, as Pascal Donoghue observed yesterday, emerge from the pandemic with a larger state. We will then face a choice of whether to shrink that state or to expand its revenues in order to meet the costs. Either way, this looks to me like a political trap. To discuss these issues, I'm joined by Managing Editor and Chief Economic Commentator Cliff Taylor. Hello, Cliff.
Hi, Pat.
And by the Labour Party Senator and former trade union economist Marie Sherlock. Hello, Marie.
Hi, Pat.
Cliff, can I turn to you first? Much of the increase in public expenditure is to deal with COVID, but not all of it is. Even if you leave aside the pandemic issues, there has been an increase in current expenditure paid for by borrowing that both Irish government policy and European rules would have prohibited prior to this. So when do you think the need to address that imbalance will hit? Is it the next budget or the one after that? Or how do you see it playing out?
You're starting with the easy question, I see. Yeah, it's funny, I was thinking about this today and was writing my column, and I predictably fudged that question because I'm not sure of the answer. I suspect it mightn't be in the next budget. I suspect it might be the one after that before the really hard decisions have to be taken. But I do think the issues are going to start bubbling up this year politically. I think the trigger for that will probably be when the government publishes its next returns to the European Commission in April, the Stability Programme Update, as it's called. And you might remember in the last budget, because of the uncertainties, there were no financial forecasts made beyond this year. So we don't know what the government expects borrowing to be in 2022 or 2023. Normally in the budget, you get, you know, 5 years in advance or whatever. So that is going to be what has to be produced in April now for the European Commission and what the government has promised to do. And I think that is going to highlight the kind of issues that you're talking about, that spending is now on a really significant upward path. I think the interesting thing about the debt report, normally it's designed to kind of, or seems to be designed to scare the life out of people. Normally the politicians, the minister of the day, the opposition, the public and everything. And it's kind of the Department of Finance's case why spending should be kept under control. But in terms of the actual emergency money spent on dealing with the pandemic, the once-off costs, it is actually pretty sanguine and that the government can continue to carry that cost, that could we can live, if you like, in the longer term with a higher level of debt that is involved in that. But as you say, there are also longer term commitments here. Some of them are to do with the pandemic directly. For example, I think we're going to have greater social protections for people in work when they're laid off for short term periods, and to help companies through short term difficulties, you know, a bigger state in those areas in future. And that, I guess, is directly related to the pandemic, as is a lot of higher spending in the health service. You know, there's no way that's going to be rolled back or much of it anyway. But remember that even before the pandemic, we were heading this direction anyway, in terms of state involvement in key areas. I mean, housing is the clearest example. Big state investment in housing planned. I think whoever came to power after the last general election would have agreed to that. So inevitably now we are seeing that move towards a bigger state and the development of a debate, I think, on how to pay for it.
Marie, the governments and central banks appear keen to avoid the mistakes made in the aftermath of the crash of 2008. And in a way, it seems that the kind of center of gravity in policymaking has shifted to the left. It has shifted in favor of a bigger state. But even though, you know, and even if, as Cliff says, governments can endure these much heavier debt burdens in part due to lower interest costs, on a current expenditure basis, that will still have to be paid for by greater revenues, won't it?
It will. I suppose there's a few points here. Firstly, in terms of this debate about debt and being able to manage debt and when is it going to become a crunch issue in the Irish political system and obviously for the public finances. I'm not so sure it's going to become a crunch issue this year unless it's politically made so, unless a crisis is manufactured, to put it centre stage. Because to be frank, and you know, and Cliff touched on this, you know, when you look at our debt servicing, our effective interest rate on Irish debt is less than 2% at the moment. And while our stock of debt is very high, what really matters is the debt servicing capacity. And we're in an exceptionally good place on that. And so I suppose to me, the key issue is how we talk about our deficit and our debt. Why do we have them? And, you know, again, Cliff talks there that the report is relatively sanguine, but generally it's designed to scare the bejesus out of most of us. Well, actually, one of the things is that I think we need to really have that conversation of how we talk about debt, because when I look at the report and it talks about, you know, debt per person in this country, you know, that to me is utterly disingenuous. We never talk about...
It's kind of meaningless,
we never, ever talk about GDP per person and a figure is put up there. Or we don't talk about tax revenue generated per person. But yet we want to kind of put this personal responsibility on everybody, this guilt on everybody, that we're all required to, you know, cough up for this debt. And of course, like, you know, the macro economy, we're not talking about households here, we're talking about the macro economy. And so there's the benefit of, we need to talk about why this debt exists, and obviously it's to ensure that that households and communities and society and indeed our and businesses can survive now and into the future, and that we're not incurring costs now that will only get bigger into the future. And I suppose, Pat, to get back to your question, that has been the lesson learnt compared with the response from the financial crisis, that there was a cost to the austerity, to the cutbacks that communities and households and businesses were reaping for many years afterwards. And we need to ensure that those costs now are not taken on by households, and that they can, you know, get to the other side of the pandemic. And yes, it is imagined hard to imagine the other side of the pandemic, but we will get there at some stage. And so in that context then, you know, we need to think about, you know, why it's important that we need to borrow, as opposed to this negative thing. And that has been the prevailing attitude and message and communication from government over the last number of years, that this is a dirty thing, it's a bad thing, when in fact, actually, when we need to think about investment for the medium and longer term, then borrowing, you know, has its use. Yes, for current expenditure, as a general rule of thumb, we should be able to raise sufficient taxes to cover that. But when it comes to investment, then we need to be able to, you know, think of borrowing as a positive thing, that it's a good thing that we can borrow at such low rates, as opposed to, you know, we all recognise that if we want to buy a house, that, you know, a mortgage, being able to access a mortgage is a good thing. Well, it's, you know, it's the same, it's similar for an economy.
But as things stand, even if you strip out the pandemic costs that have been put into current expenditure, the current expenditure, and let's say the pandemic passes, the current expenditure will not be supported by the levels of taxation that we went into the pandemic with. So you're left with this imbalance. Am I wrong in that? Because that seems to me to be the crux of the political problem. I don't think that there are policymakers anywhere who are saying, you know, that the levels of debt taken on during the pandemic crisis need to be bridged through cuts in public expenditure that gives you a second age of austerity. I don't think anybody is suggesting that.
Not yet.
But there is still an imbalance, or there will be an imbalance between between current expenditure and current revenue, speaking very roughly, which will have to be met either by the reduction of one or the increase of the other.
And I think it's very widely accepted that pre-pandemic, that Ireland very much found itself in a low spend, low tax environment when we compare with many other EU member states. Now, of course, within certain sectors, it's not necessarily low spend. You look at health, for instance, we spend above EU average, but it's the allocation of that money, like 26% of health spending in this country is goes into the hands of private insurers and into private hospitals. So, you know, we need to look at the allocation of money. But to go back to your point, yes, there is absolutely an issue here with regards to how we finance the state into the future in a sustainable fashion. And I suppose there's two things to say on that. Firstly, I think, you know, we should be able to imagine, you know, that there's been a number of sacred cows or things we never thought previously imaginable are imaginable now in terms of support to a childcare sector, in terms of the level of supports within the health sector, telemedicine, embracing that, and indeed buying up capacity or certainly leasing capacity as necessary in health. So we can imagine, I suppose, a different type of state now. But in terms of the financing of that, well, there's three things. Firstly, you know, the pandemic, we hope, is a once-off, once-in-a-generation event. And of course, we don't know that. But I think we've all learned a lot about epidemiology over the last number, or about viruses, certainly, over, and that there may be another crisis coming down the line. But if we assume it's a one-in-a-generation event, then there needs to be a once-off taxation event to, I suppose, pay down some of that debt that has been accumulated that directly relates to the pandemic. And it's really interesting. If you look in the UK, the London School of Economics have a commission on taxation, and they produced a really important report there just before Christmas looking at wealth, and they're calling for a once-off wealth tax on citizens in the UK at a rate of 1% above a particular threshold. So that's something that, you know, we need to start talking about here, a once-off tax event. Number two, there's a number of low-hanging fruit within our tax system. And again, you know, when you look at how corporate gains tax and stamp duty have been calibrated over the last number of years to very much appeal and appease demands by certain elements of the business community, not all, but certain elements of the business community, then I think we need to look at how we recalibrate that, particularly with regards to the rate and the exemptions within capital gains tax and indeed for non-residential stamp duty. And then number three, you know, we do need to look at our corporate tax rate, and as a starting point, the minimum effective corporate tax rate. We have one for personal income taxes. No reason whatsoever we shouldn't have one for a corporate tax rate. And, you know, as Cliff has written about so often, you know, there are decisions that most likely would be foisted upon us coming down the line. But we have the capacity to act in advance of that, particularly when you look at the BEPS process, when you look at the digital sales tax debate that's taking place across Europe at the moment. So that is an area we need to move on. And I suppose that the last area, and it's really, you know, relates to, I suppose, the rate of PRSI, so pay related social insurance, that both employees and employers pay in this country. And, you know, to say that there's a lot of employers at the moment who are in huge difficulty, but I think it is accepted that we need everybody to be paying, or certainly we need employers paying more for what might be called the social wage. We realise now that, you know, it's that, like, in order for to attract employees, to keep employees, they need to be able to access public services like good housing, like education, like a good health service. And so that can't all be taken on by the employee themselves, that the state needs to stump up, and therefore there needs to be perhaps a higher rate of PRSI. And it's interesting that IBEC have, very much, I won't say very much, but have certainly made very positive noises about that over the past several months, because they realise too that we're not going to resolve this housing crisis, we're not going to resolve the childcare issues, affordability issues, which ultimately, if we do resolve, make it easier to attract and retain staff in particular parts of this country. So I think, you know, we need to open up all those debates over the coming months about how we finance our economy and our public services into the future.
Cliff, there tends to be an inexhaustible number of ideas about things that the state should do for people and services that the state should provide. But a similarly inexhaustible list of reasons as to why I or you or Marie shouldn't be the ones to pay for them with increased taxes on us. I have a long list of other people that should be subjected to tax increases. But what's your view of the politics of that? I mean, it sounds like, and it seems to me, that some level of tax increases will be unavoidable. And the approach of government tends to be to spread that as thinly as possible upon as large an area as possible.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think this is going to be the meat and drink of it, and it's going to be a tricky one politically. And as you know, Pascal Donoghue is to set up this commission on tax and welfare. And the idea on that is to come up with some thinking in this area and some recommendations. And I think this plays into the idea that we're maybe talking about a 2022 issue rather than one that's going to rear its head this year fully anyway. But if he's looking for political cover from that, or any kind of a cross-party consensus on the lines of what we saw in Sláintecare, for example, I think he's probably wasting his time, because, you know, there's going to be fights over this. Where do you look for new money? I mean, I'd agree with Marie on one thing, in that I think PRSI is an area that's definitely going to be targeted. And as you say, we always want other people to pay, so it's good to get employers to pay a bit more, everybody thinks, apart from the employers. And given the low rate of employers' PRSI here, I think that is certainly going to be subject to a significant hike over the next few years, probably on some kind of calibrated basis. Maybe not ideal when you're coming out of a pandemic and there's a job crisis coming up, in that you're increasing the cost of employing people. But with greater social protections likely, it's probably unavoidable. It does get more difficult if you're talking about increasing PRSI on people, on employees as well. But I kind of think that's probably going to be unavoidable, because if you're looking at raising large amounts of money, you need to hit large numbers of people. And if the government finds increasing income tax impossible, and it says it does, well, then PRSI is possibly one of the only other places that you can look to. I'm not sure I agree with Marie in terms of corporation tax, in the sense that we've got such a huge gain out of that over the last few years. I think the goal is going to be to try to hold on to as much of that as possible, while maybe changing some of the allowances and special measures that allow companies to pay a long way below the 12.5% rate. But there are other issues, I think, that are going to come into the picture. Marie mentioned a wealth tax there, and I think it is an issue that's going to be looked at. But one of the difficulties is, it's international experience suggests, it is a difficult one in terms of actually raising a large amounts of cash. You know, maybe it makes people feel better that the wealthier are being hit, or the super rich are being hit, or their special allowances or their ability to stay outside the country for large periods of the year are being tightened, or whatever it is. But I suspect the amount of money that might come from that may not be enormous. So then you come back to other things. The local property tax has been dodged and ducked as an issue now for 8 or 9 years in terms of the reform of that. It really is an area that needs to be looked at in terms of funding local authorities. And you come on to other tricky ones, like the retirement age. That's been put to another commission because the government didn't want to face up to it. But you're probably talking about something that costs $400 or $500 million a year in terms of putting off the decision that the age should increase. So these are going to be, I think, the meat and drink of the debate we're going to see over the next few years. And I think, you know, there are various things the government can do to make people feel better and hit the real high rollers and hit the big companies. But if you want to raise a lot of money, you have to hit a lot of people. That's what experience tends to suggest, and that's where it gets difficult.
Marie Cliff is you know, saying that there's likely to be fights about this. My view is that there should be fights about this. I mean, the size of the state and who pays for it, these are kind of the central organisational and distributional questions of politics, and people have legitimately different views on this, which they should in turn put before the voters and allow the voters to choose. So I for one kind of look forward to these fights.
Well, I think one of the difficulties when you start talking about taxation is that, you know, if you start talking about any of the technical aspects of taxation, you immediately lose people, right? I don't believe there should be a change in the rates of income tax anytime soon. In fact, for a long time, there's no need to change the rates of income tax at the moment. And we have the USC in situ, and that's not going to go away, or so it seems, notwithstanding initial government commitments. And so I don't think that there is a need to do much in terms of to do anything in the space for workers on average incomes at this point in time, except, right, this is where you can get into looking at the tax, not credit, but the 1350, the tax credit.
The tax allowance.
Exactly, that, you know, for high-income workers, do they need to get that, right? We need to look at the precise detail within corporate gains tax. Do we need to have an entrepreneurial relief? Do we need to have a reduced rate?
That's all pretty small potatoes, though, isn't it?
But no, but the point is, right, and that's why a commission is really important, right? Because in some ways, you see, the very minute you start trying to have these big debates across the airwaves about what type of tax system, you're going to lose people in terms of the, you know, the small potatoes. But this, but they're all really important in ensuring, A, that we have a fairer tax system, and B, that we build it up towards a more sustainably funded system of public services over the long run. So I suppose maybe it's the economy, you know, the policy person in me wants to look at the detail as opposed to saying, oh, we're moving income tax up by 2% or cutting by 2%, which inevitably those, I think, you know, who want the debate want to see us argue about. But I don't think that debate is going to play out, because I think there's an absolute acknowledgement now that this pandemic will have exacerbated inequality in this country, or has exacerbated inequality in this country. And when you look at the low-income households working in particular sectors, so like the retail sector, like the wholesale sector, like the hospitality sector, you know, those sectors will suffer damage, and the people working in those sectors will suffer that legacy effect perhaps for many years. People working in other sectors won't have experienced that same difficulty at all. And I think we just need to be very careful about changes we do need to make to the tax. We need to make changes to the tax system, but who it affects over the medium and long term. Because, you know, being honest, some people are now faced with having to retrain for different jobs. And other people, okay, they're sitting at the edge of the bed, they're having to put up with crap conditions in terms of working from home, but they've got their job, they've got their income coming in. We see the savings rate in this country at the moment, it's gone up to 35%, you know? And obviously that has led some to believe that we're going to have a very large boost to consumption, to consumer spending when this pandemic is over. You know, who knows? We don't know whether people will be a bit more conservative and cautious about their spending or not. We don't know. But I think the thing is, yes, a debate does need to be had. I'm not sure Pat is going to play out in the way that perhaps some would like it to play out, because I think it does need to be nuanced. And ultimately, it is about changing, you know, like something like corporate capital gains tax needs an overhaul, but something like income tax Well, that's a much more sensitive issue. And I think certainly the argument is not proven at the moment that we need to have a substantial increase in rates.
I mean, income tax cliff, I suppose, is where, as Marie says, the real political sensitivity hits. And I've no doubt that, you know, someday in the future, you will end up on one of these grand state-run commissions, which are intended, you know, to provide politicians with easy answers to questions to which there are no easy answers. I mean, if you look at, say, income tax, one of the, you know, Ireland is an outlier in Europe. Or say, if you were to compare the Irish income tax system to many European income tax systems, the chief difference is that people on low to medium incomes pay very little income tax here in comparison to what they pay in places like Sweden and Germany, which have those bigger states which we may now be assembling. And, you know, who knows what the as yet unformed commission is going to find. But I can guarantee you one thing, it's not going to recommend that people on lower incomes should pay more income tax.
Pat, can I just interrupt for a second, right? Like, people, yes, they may pay, relative to other high-income countries, pay lower income tax, but they're paying far more in terms of their housing, their access to their health, in terms of childcare.
For sure. The cost of living is obviously much higher here, and the level of services in things like childcare and healthcare that is received in return, I suppose, for income tax is much lower. I absolutely take that point. Sorry, Cliff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. And I think one of the things that would be really useful for the commission to scope out is to look at income tax and PRSI in a few different countries and look at what people get in return. So, for example, one of my sons has just gone to Germany and be paying kind of a higher rate of social insurance there. But as part of that, he effectively gets health insurance, you know, which removes another huge cost from his budget. So I think, you know, there is a debate on increasing things like PRSI. But if there's going to be any public support for that, I think people are going to have to see the payoff on the other, you know, very much on the other side in terms of what they're going to get back in return, if that debate is ever going to be won. I think you're right that the income tax is obviously always going to be central to tax debates. And particularly when you look at the way that Sinn Féin set out its stall in the last general election campaign, one of their key cash-raising proposals was, you know, an extra income tax levy. I think it was of 3% on higher incomes, versus what Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are saying, ruling out higher income tax under any, you know, pretty much under any circumstance. So I think there you have the divide. You know, Sinn Féin looking at higher taxes on higher earners, and the government, you know, ruling out any income tax changes at all. I mean, as you say, when you do look at international comparisons of our income tax structure, higher tax people do generally probably pay a bit more than the average, certainly in terms of marginal rates, and I think generally overall as well. When you get to the higher levels, middle earners may be roughly the same, and lower earners, you know, particularly lower earners with families, doing well. But then, you know, you come back to the debate of what you get in return. And as Marie said, the other costs, I guess the conundrum is that even though they pay low tax, the lower earners, you know, still face a relatively high cost of living. So that's the political difficulty of this.
Can I just say, like, I suppose, you know, Cliff has touched on something very important there, right? It's about, like, what people get back in return, right? And, you know, we have this argument, oh, tax need to go up, but tax need to go down, and who pays and whatever else. And my colleague Jed Nash, you know, always talks about this unwritten social contract. And, like, what does that mean to the person at home? It's what they get back in return for, you know, in terms of knowing that there's an education system that functions out there, that they can get health in a timely manner, that they, you know, that if, you know, God forbid, if their child is diagnosed with autism, that there is services out there, and indeed that there is affordable housing. And I suppose, again, right, like that debate, we need to find a new language about, you know, how, why ensuring that we have a sustainable public finances is important. And I'm not sure any of us on the left have really got it right over the last number of years. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about debt. You know, we talk about debt as a bad thing as opposed to something that's a means to an end. And I think in terms of if people can see why it's important to pay, then it, you know, that then and why it's important that everybody pays and in an equitable manner. Because to be frank about it, I think there is a resentment out there that that, you know, there has been a lot of focus by I suppose this government is relatively new, but by the previous government on ensuring that there was tax measures put in place for, you know, particularly with regards to, let's say, some of the CGT measures and a kind of a real Ulster says no approach to doing anything with regards to corporate tax or indeed, tax that, you know, is, I suppose, that affects business or other high income individuals in this country, because it's fear, oh, we'll scare them away. And I think there has been an unfair debate around all that. And we need to try and find a new language. And I'd be the first to say we need to find a new language. We need to find a way to actually reach out to people and communicate to people about why public services. And I don't like that term because, you know, people don't fully understand, you know, why an education system, why a health system, why public transport is important and why it needs to be funded.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think a lot of this really goes back to the crisis that struck in 2008 and the aftermath of it and the austerity. And you know, then after that, we saw the water charges, marches. And it seems, to my mind, to have kind of broken the link in people's heads between taxes and spending. And between that idea of, you know, paying something in your taxes and getting something back in your services, because people just felt it was unfair and therefore decided they didn't want to pay any more taxes. And I think that has really kind of damaged the debate since. And it's damaged kind of policy action since as well. You know, we saw it, I suppose, in the water charges. That idea was abandoned. It's hit investment surely in the water network in the meantime, or it's meant money has had to come from somewhere else. And the ridiculousness of the local property tax, where you have houses, anyone who's moved into a new house since 2013 has not had to pay the tax at all, whereas their neighbour up the road, you know, in an old house is paying 300 or 400 or 500 euro a year. It's a small example, but I think it's just a symptomatic of kind of the way politics here has kind of moved back from that debate. And any idea of increasing taxes or increasing charges or putting extra obligations on people is just has just been a no-no ever since the period of austerity. And I think, as you say, we need to find some way out of that. I mean,
those questions are unavoidable, Cliff, aren't they?
Yeah, but just I suppose to kind of maybe have a go at both sides of the debate. If we're talking about taxing wealth or you know, taxing the wealth that people have, I mean, the main wealth of Irish households is their houses. So why, for example, are Sinn Féin opposing any changes in the local property tax or the local property tax at all, actually, because they want it abolished, as I understand? Because that is a charge on people's key asset. That is a charge on people's wealth. And, you know, and if you were to look then at the obsession of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and some of the right-wing parties with inheritance tax and making sure that it's cheaper and easier for people to pass on assets, primarily their family home, to their kids, well, there's another way of taxing people's wealth. You know, if you want to tax wealth, the easiest way to do it is via people's inheritance. You can try and create some kind of a general wealth tax and get people to declare their wealth. And, you know, there have been attempts to do it. And I do think that's going to move back on the agenda. But there are easier ways to do it in the short term. It's just politically, it seems really difficult to go there in any of these routes.
Marie, these questions, by their nature, tend to break down on a sort of left-right axis. Do you think that they will accelerate that sort of left-right divide in Irish politics that I think we're seeing between Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael on one side, Sinn Féin and everybody else, or most other people on the other?
So I think there is a new cleavage, if we can call it that, emerging. I think it was always there, but you kind of had the two centre-right parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and then Labour and the other parties and the other side, and the numbers, the arithmetic is different now. So I think that cleavage is certainly more clear cut, and I think, you know, that will lend itself to a more clear cut debate in future elections. But I think the one thing though is that there are some who claim to be of the left, and yet then run away from, you know, it's always easier for somebody else to be paying, and then property tax is that really good example. And at the end of the day, none of us want to be paying tax, right? And, you know, that's just a simple reality. But again, going back to that thing, if we know it's going to pay for the bin collection, of course, it no longer pays for the bin collection. I wanted to be able to pay for the bin collection outside. But if we know if it pays for the roads, if it pays for our health service, whatever else, then it's an important thing to do. And I think in particular on property tax, like there's just been a huge inconsistency, which Sinn Féin and indeed other parties who have just rejected it. Like at the end of the day, it is a relatively, when you compare with the amounts that other people are paying in tax, the property tax payment, it is a big payment when it's 300 or 400 euros, you know, in one installment or indeed spread out. But the thing is, compared with other taxes, you know, it needs to be part of that range of taxes that we pay. Those of us who enjoy, you know, the asset that is a house, right? If we ever wanted to sell it on. And who, you know, enjoyed mortgage interest relief when it was available, that is not available to tenants, to renters. And bearing in mind, there's a growing cohort of people that will never have benefited from mortgage interest relief. Like we've 30% of our population, not more, who are renting at the moment and will never expect to own their houses, never, or to own a house during their lifetime. And so there is a growing divide between those who at some stage will own the asset, which is their house. And I don't like talking about houses as assets because it's a home, right? First and foremost. But in time when their mortgage is paid off, you know, and if they wanted to sell, you know, they're able to do that, unlike somebody who's renting. So there is a cleavage there. But I think the other thing is as well that...
Yeah. Is that a haves and have-nots cleavage?
And I think that is, like, we see that in our labour market. We see that in housing. In particular, when we look at our labour market at the moment, like the really striking thing, and there's a generational issue here. Like when you look at the numbers who are dependent on the temporary wage subsidy scheme, the under 25s and the over 25s, I was just looking at this data the other day. So the over 25s, you're about 2.5 times more likely to be on the PUP payment than you are on the temporary wage subsidy scheme. For the under 25s, it's almost 4 times more likely to be on the PUP payment than on the temporary wage subsidy scheme. And that's a reflection of the insecurity of work, just being in the door. And of course, we know there's going to be redundancies coming down the track, and it's going to be first in, last out, and some not able to get work at all. So I think there's a huge issue coming down the line for those who, you know, are going to be new into a labour market and there's jobs simply not there, or they're only going to be available in certain sectors. So we do have this Ireland now where there is the haves and the have-nots, and how we respond to that is going to be really important.
I think it will be one of the things that defines the political choices actually that lie ahead of us when the pandemic passes and we move to a situation where political choices can't be fudged anymore. But listen, that's all we have time for this episode of Inside Politics. My thanks to Senator Marie Sherlock and to our own Cliff Taylor. Podcast was produced by Declan Conlon with JJ Vernon on sound. Until the next time, goodbye and thanks very much for listening.